77. Slack rope. The guerreros were not waiting for him when he left the dark bed of the track, blinking under artificial sunlight. Instead, he discovered Ochun, calm and supple amid this noise and iron, hundreds of engines, the shifting of great weights. She lent him a looseness he wouldn't have felt otherwise, after meeting the madman in the grey car, and, too suddenly, Oshosi. Standing to one side of a crowded passage, between stacked containers, he let the black rope snake off his ribs, swaying slightly to encourage it. When it lay at his feet, he picked up an end of it and coiled it, slinging it over his shoulder. Making sure his identification tag was visible, he picked up two sealed, almost empty, cans of paint from a clutter of such things and walked on, making certain he walked a little more quickly, more purposefully, than the men around him. He stepped aside for specialised vehicles, forklifts, a first aid wagon. When he judged that he'd gone as far as he should, he circled a stack of containers and came back, still walking as quickly, a man whose paint was needed and who knew exactly where he was going. As indeed he did, as he was 15 feet from the stack topped with the old man's container, when the bells and buzzers, signalling the start of the midnight shift, all sounded. Looking up, he thought he saw a disturbance in the air, there, moving quickly down the length of the turquoise container. He remembered the guerreros, twisting the air in Union Square, but they were not here. He set his paint cans aside, where they wouldn't be tripped over, took latex gloves from his pocket, put them on, and walked to the end of the stack of three containers. They were stacked with their doors at the same end, as he had been told they would be. He wiggled the black respirator out of his jacket pocket and removed it from its bag. Pocketing the bag, he removed his hard hat, put the respirator on, adjusted it, put his hard hat back on. Neither of these things were particularly good for slack rope, he thought, but Ochun was accepting. He stepped aside, nodding as a forklift drove past. The doors of the containers were locked, with hinged vertical steel rods, sealed with tags of metal and coloured plastic. He drew the plastic rectangle from the front of his jeans, pulled its paracord over his hard hat, and climbed up the three door rods, the soles of his Adidas GSG9 boots easily gripping the painted steel of the doors. He climbed, as Ochun suggested, as though he were delighted to do so, with no more purpose in mind than proving that he could. His breath was loud in the black respirator. He ignored it. Reaching the damp, slick top of the turquoise container, he climbed up and moved in, away from the edge. He crouched there, suddenly aware of something he couldn't name. The goddess, the noise of the port, the old man, the 10 painted discs slung around his neck like blank sigils. Something was about to change. In the world, in his life, he didn't know. He closed his eyes, saw the blue vase glowing softly where he'd hidden it on the roof of his building. Accept this. I do, he told her. Crouching, he moved to the far end of the container. At each corner, as Gareth had explained, there was a bracket, a sort of loop, with which these boxes could be fastened together. He threaded one end of his rope through the bracket on the side furthest from the ocean he could not see. He moved to the opposite end, playing out his rope, and knotted its other end. The black rope slid off the side of the container's roof, fastened at either end. He looked down at the slack rope, where it hung against the side of the blue container. He hoped he'd judged the give of the nylon correctly. It was good rope, climbing rope. I do, he said to Ochun, and slid down the rope, slowing himself with the sides of his Adidas. Slowly, gloved palms against the painted steel, he stood upright on the rope, knees slightly bent. Between the toes of his black shoes, concrete. Directly in front of his face was the first of Gareth's bullet holes. The steel around it was bare, edges bright. He pulled the first of his magnets from its plastic pocket and placed it over the hole. It bonded with a container with a sharp click, trapping a fold of his latex glove. He carefully tore his hand free, picking off the dangling bit. He moved his left foot, his left hand, his right foot, his right hand. He covered the second hole, careful this time not to catch his glove. A forklift rolled past, beneath him. He remembered bringing the old man the first of the iPods, in Washington Square, by the chess tables. Snow. He saw now how that had changed things, had brought him here. He covered the third hole, moved on. He remembered having soup with Alejandro. The fourth disc clicked in place. He moved. Five. Three men walked past, beneath him, their hard hats round buttons of plastic. Two red, one blue. He stood with his palms flat against the cold steel. Six. He remembered running with the Guerreros through Union Square. Seven and eight were within a foot of one another. Click and click. Nine. He climbed back up, feet against the blue wall. He undid the knot at that end and let the rope go. He walked to the other end, where it hung straight, coiling on the concrete below, and slid down. He pulled down the hot respirator, gulped cool unfiltered air, and flicked the second knot free. The rope fell into his arms, and he quickly coiled it, then walked away. Out of sight of the old man's container, he tossed the rope, the respirator, and the bag it had come in into a dumpster. He left his shredded gloves on the fender of a forklift. The green jacket went into an empty cement bag and into another dumpster. He pulled the hood of his black sweatshirt up and put his hard hat on. O'Toole was gone. Now he must get out of this place. He saw a diesel train engine rumble slowly past, 100 yards in front of him, painted with black and white diagonals. It was pulling a train of flat cars, each one carrying a container. He walked on. He was almost out when the helicopter came, out of nowhere, sweeping the tracks with its bubble of insanely bright light. He'd just taken 10 minutes, trying to find a path through brambles after jumping off his train. He'd thought he was well clear, that he had plenty of time. Now here he was, jeans caught on wire, on top of this 6-foot fence, like a child, no sistema at all. He saw the helicopter swing up, then out, toward where the sea must be. Still turning, coming back. He threw himself off the fence, feeling his jeans tear. "Dude," someone said, "you gotta know they got motion detectors in there." "Coming back," another boy said, pointing. Tito got to his feet, prepared to run. Suddenly, the narrow park leapt into shivering, seemingly shadowless incandescence, the helicopter somewhere high above the new green leaves of the trees. Tito and three others at the core of the beam. Two of them were resting a full-sized electric piano across the back of a bench, giving the helicopter the finger with their free hands. The other, grinning, had a white, wolf-shouldered dog on a red nylon lead. "I'm Igor, man."
"Ramon,"
as the light went out.
"You want to help us move, man? We got a new practice space. Beer."
"Sure,"
said Tito, knowing he needed to get off the street.
"You play anything?"
asked Igor.
"Keyboards."
The white dog licked Tito's hand.
"Awesome," said Igor.